Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. This is episode number 824, exciting one. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation today. We have some people back with us in the program that haven't been on in a little while, but certainly overdue. Let me introduce to you first, we have all the way from Croatia today. He's usually based out of Michigan, Hillsdale, Michigan. We have Richard M. Gamble, professor of history, and holding the Anne Margaret Ross Alexander Chair in History and Politics at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome back, Richard. It's great to see you today.
It's great to be here. I enjoyed our time together last time and look forward to this.
Yeah, if I recall, it must have been at least maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, because it was when I was still recording at church before we had our previous office. So yeah, we'll have to have you back in a couple of weeks and average out the delay between episodes. We'll make it happen. We're very delighted to have you with us. Glad you can make it even all the way from Croatia on your sabbatical. So thanks for pitching in. We look forward to your contribution. We also have with us today the author of the chapter that we're going to be focusing on, Jeffrey McDonald. We've had Jeff on before to talk about Gerstner and to talk about Machen and Melvin Grove Kyle. Jeff is a Presbyterian minister, historian. He's the author of John Gerstner and the Renewal of Presbyterian and Reformed Evangelicalism in Modern America, which you can find from Whip and Stock, published 2017. Look in the episode description for links to our previous episodes. But Jeff, it's great to see you too. Welcome back.
Yeah, great to be here, Camden. Thanks so much for having me.
You're most welcome. We're very glad to have you and to talk about important things. Today, we're going to be speaking about William Jennings Bryan, the Roundtable Club, and religious freedom. Jeff has authored a new chapter in a book titled The Gospel and Religious Freedom. This was published recently. Just this year, back in June, at least as the website says, by Baylor University Press. The title of the book is The Gospel and Religious Freedom, Historical Studies in Evangelicalism and Political Engagement. It's edited by David W. Bebbington, certainly a name many people will recognize. So take a look at that book. We'll have links in the episode description as well to find that. But before we get into the subject of today's conversation, I would like to at least introduce and make known the Presbyterian Scholars Conference. We've mentioned that before in previous episode, but looking forward, at least in terms of when we record, to meeting again in just a couple weeks in Wheaton, Illinois, on the campus somewhat, across the street somewhat from Wheaton College at Harbor House, which is owned and operated by Wheaton College, but it's a former home just right there on the main drag. And Jeff, certainly, is very much involved because he organizes and manages this conference. Jeff, would you mind telling us a bit about it? I think as the schedule is going to fall out, this episode will air. At least it'll come out before the conference happens. So there might be opportunity for some people to make some plans and head on over to Wheaton in time for the event.
Yeah, we'd love to have anyone come and attend. It's a great conference. There's a great fellowship, and there's a lot of great papers and great book panels and great scholarly interaction. So, we have, you can look up Presbyterian Scholars Conference 2023 and find my email and just email me to register. And it's you can pay the registration. It's $50 at the door, and that covers all your meals. But this year, it's a special year. It's the 100th anniversary of J. Gresham Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism. So there'll be a special paper on that book, one paper, and then there'll be a 2-hour long plus book panel on that book. And we're going to have we have outstanding historians who are going to be discussing Machen's work. We have Daryl Hart, and we have Tim Larson, and Camden will be discussing that book as well, and many others. So I just invite anyone, if you're interested, to look at the conference schedule. We'd love to have you come. We have the conference is advertised on the Conference of Faith and History website, but it's also advertised on the Presbyterian Scholars website, which is psconference.org. So love to have you attend.
Great. psconference.org. Yeah, it would be great to have everyone there. I'm looking forward to the 2 days or so speaking with other scholars. I enjoy all the sessions. I've been for 2 years now, and it's a unique place. It's really a wonderful time. And even just being able to sit down to lunch and speak with some exceedingly significant Presbyterian scholars, I feel like I'm the riffraff who just snuck in, gets to eat next to George Marsden, Mark Knoll, just have lunch with them. I'm beside myself. So I thank you for organizing that and scheduling it. It's also a tremendous example, I think, of charitable conversation. Maybe Richard, you could fill me in on this, but I'm not a trained historian. I have a PhD in historical and theological studies, but I'm more properly understood as a systematician or biblical theologian of sorts. But I've been thrust into some Presbyterian history willingly, but I've been kind of tossed in as the OPC historian now. But in systematic theology, usually when you get a bunch of scholars together, especially from different perspectives or different, slightly different traditions, it can often become more contentious and competitive, you know, and the systematicians always want to, you know, get to the bottom of things and determine exactly what's right. And I don't mean to say that historians don't want to get to the bottom of things and find precision. And certainly there's that. And rigor in the study, of course. But I just find a different affect among scholars. Maybe it's a testament to you, Jeff, in terms of the type of people you invite, but the people there, even when they disagree, it's still fun and pleasant and charitable and constructive. And it doesn't seem like people get all agitated and leave with hurt feelings the way the systematicians typically converse. You got any thoughts on that, either of you, Richard or Jeff?
I'm ready to sign up after
that. What is it about historians? I think surely, you know, it's just, I guess this is a short way for me to say, it looks like, I think historians just have more fun hanging out with each other. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say.
I think that's the first time historians have ever been accused of being fun. It might be true.
Oh, man. Whatever, we'll take it, right? Right. So that it's a wonderful event. It truly is. It's a special thing, and I encourage people to take a look at it. If you're in the area or not, get to the area. It's a wonderful setting. I even love how it's all organized in terms of the space. The Harbor House is a really cool little, it's a converted house, but there's plenty of room when we're eating. But during the sessions, everything is in a very large oval. So it's not like if you're going to ETS or something like that, and you're looking at one speaker, but then you're looking at the back of everyone else's head or something. It feels a lot more collaborative and oriented around constructive discussion, even just the way that the chairs are.
Yeah, I think it's a really good, you know, small conference venue. It's where the Wheaton College Board of Trustees meets. So it's just a nice wood paneled, big, large, you know, conference room. And there's the house mm-hmm. that's a part of it. So the meals are easy. You don't have to go anywhere for the meals. But I think, you know, maybe the reason, people are saying that they enjoy the fellowship so much is that the conference is really rare. You know, we have people from the PCUSA scholars that come, leaders, you know, like Brad Longfield, who is a professor of church history at the University of Duke Seminary, comes. He's, you know, been there every year. And we have other PCUSA scholars come. Richard Burnett will be there from Theology Matters. And he's also working at the University of Duke Seminary now. Mm-hmm. But we have, you know, PCUSA, EPC scholars come. We have OPC scholars come. And the interaction is really good. And we've even had, you know, scholars from the Presbyterian Church in Canada come, and we've had one paper on Mexican Presbyterian history given by the vice president of the National Presbyterian Church of Mexico. So it's really a rare opportunity to come and learn from other, you know, Presbyterians and to just converse with each other and have fellowship and try to learn from the different presentations. I think church historians maybe have a little bit more of a desire for church unity maybe than systematic theologians. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
I had one church historian tell me that one time, and that was David Calhoun, who taught church history for many decades at Covenant Seminary. He thought he thought that church historians were more focused on the unity of the church. But that's just a few comments there. But
yeah, I appreciate that, Jeff. That's interesting. We can get, if we had Daryl on the program, maybe Richard, you've had this conversation with him, where he likes to talk about splitters and lumpers.
Yeah,
maybe that's another question in terms of approaches to history, but that's fun. But we're going to talk today about another Presbyterian, an American Presbyterian, but one who intersects not merely the Presbyterian Church, but the history of this nation significantly. I don't mean this as disrespectfully, but in my memory, I often remember William, the way I recall his political engagement, whatever mnemonic device or whatever synapse is connected in my head, I tend to think of William Jennings Bryan as the Buffalo Bills of the Democratic Party, because he's been to the Super Bowl 3 times and he never won it. So the Bills being there 4 times, obviously, but he was nominated for president 3 times and had trouble.
George Marzin, making it through, Marzin calls him the George Custer of American fundamentalism.
This is the kind of stuff we get at the Presbyterian Scholars Conference. You can come for these rich insights. I like it. So, Jeff, first off, I'd love to hear you introduce the subject. I mean, explain to us more, you know, provide maybe a brief biographical sketch or the significance of William Jennings Bryan, but also your interest in writing about him for this particular book on the theme of religious freedom.
Yeah, well, I would say for about 15 years, I, you know, really was not very interested in Bryan. I was very interested in Presbyterian history, conservative Presbyterian history, evangelical Presbyterian history. And so really did a lot of research in those areas. And even though I was from Nebraska, I was very aware of Bryan, but not, you know, very interested in him, because I think his reputation is that, you know, he was a famous politician, but someone who was not, you know, a confessional Presbyterian, someone who, you know, was not, you know, a theologian. So I just wasn't too interested in political history. So for many, many years, I wrote on other topics and did research on other topics. I did my MA in history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And so there I did get a good taste of they emphasize the history of populism, especially the history of prairie populism. And so I think that was, you know, I was a evangelical Presbyterian student there, but, you know, learned quite a bit about the history of populism. So picked that up there, but, you know, went on and did research on other things. But after I did my PhD and published my book, I was invited to a conference at the University of Notre Dame. And there were a lot of Christian historians there, a lot of evangelical historians there. Daryl was there. And there was a lot of, you know, there just wasn't a good understanding at this conference about, I felt, of evangelical populism. And for many years, I really didn't understand Bryan. But after hearing all these, you know, historians, you know, Bryan's ideas began to make more sense in my mind. And so when I drove back to Nebraska, this was kind of the first time I said, you know, now I'm starting to understand more of Bryan's perspective and his populist thought. Because I felt at the conference there was a lot of just failing to take into consideration, you know, the evangelical populist impulse. And specifically, the issue was Kristen Dumais from Calvin University and her presentation on why evangelicals, you know, voted for Trump. And I just didn't think she brought in to that discussion the history of populism. And, you know, my position is not a political one, but I just think that populism is just not taken, you know, very seriously by too many evangelical historians. And so when this book topic, this is actually came from a Baylor University conference on religious freedom, I thought, well, I'm gonna dig into, you know, more on Brian and kind of understand his viewpoint. And Brian's often portrayed as someone who is not an intellectual, someone who is not, he wasn't a professor, someone who, you know, is kind of an anti-intellectual or someone who's intellectually irresponsible. Right. But going through the Paulo Coletta three-volume history published by the University of Nebraska in the 1960s and 70s, one of the things I noticed in there was that Brian actually started an intellectual club. And so I took that from Coletta, and he didn't discuss it any further, but I took that and tried to research about that club and who was a part of this club and what was going on. And in doing that, I discovered that Brian was very connected to, you know, to other scholars. He had a lot of, you know, he had discussion partners who were leading scholars in their field, and he knew, you know, the chancellor, several of the chancellors of the University of Nebraska, you know, very well. And so this chapter, I think, presents Brian as far more intellectually engaged than historians have previously realized. And, you know, so that's what the chapter's about, and how these conversation partners he had in this intellectual club kind of help shape his ideas on religious freedom. He became very concerned about what was going on in the universities, and he became concerned that you know, students were being, that their faith was being undermined, you know, in the universities. Mm. And so you know, my chapter tries to present his concerns and what he tried to do to stop that.
Yeah. There's so many themes that are applicable to the present day. And Richard, I'd love to hear also your take on this in a minute, especially being a professor at Hillsdale, which is certainly has a great reputation for seeking intellectual rigor and freedom from the government influence and whatnot. But Jeff, what are some of the reasons, especially for people that aren't familiar with Brian's background and some of the contextual items, the historical context of his life, what are some of the reasons why he's known potentially as a anti-intellectual of sorts? Perhaps is it largely revolving around the Scopes trial?
Yeah, I think the Scopes trial is the main reason. You know, some historians, you know, really hold that, you know, his performance there was not very good. But what I try to...
He was the attorney representing the case,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. And so, yeah. You know, many attorneys or scholars will say, well, why, you know, why would you testify when you're the attorney, you know, in the case? You know, that's really not a good legal move. So, you know, I think there's various criticisms to be made of Brian, you know, at the Scopes trial. But what I'm trying to do here in this chapter is just provide added context. There's more to the story. Here. And then one thing that's often forgot, you know, people criticize Brian, you know, for the Scopes trial and that he performed, you know, very poorly. But oftentimes it's not mentioned that the textbook at issue in the case, you know, did teach eugenics. So that issue doesn't get brought up.
Mm-hmm. Richard, what is your experience with Brian? Do you intersect here?
Yeah. And as Jeff knows well, the popular impression of William Jennings Bryan comes from the movie Inherit the Wind and from the play that was based on. And if you look at teachers' manuals for secondary school teachers for American history, they still consistently recommend showing Inherit the Wind as a way to teach the Scopes trial, which is about the worst thing you can do to understand the Scopes trial. And that film actually is more about the Red Scare of the 1950s than it really is about what was going on in Dayton, Tennessee. And what comes out of that film is a portrayal of an ignorant fundamentalist country bumpkin who couldn't hold his own intellectually against the big city elites, the newspaper men, the editors, defense attorneys. So that's hard to fight against, that popular impression. But if you take time to look at the trial transcripts, and they were published right after the trial and are available on Google Books and elsewhere, and you start going through that page by page, a very different William Jennings Bryan emerges from that. And I might not have said what he said, but he was not a literal six-day creationist. He was funny, smart, could think on his feet, and responded to Clarence Darrow as well as anybody probably could have. And he, of course, had the audience there, but the people at the trial were clearly on his side. And as a populist figure, he had millions and millions of Americans on his side. And I like that Jeff is drawing that out about him, and our failure today to understand a figure like Bryan. It would be hard to come up with a parallel today. Trump is an interesting comparison to very different people, but how there could be a massive movement that takes the elites by surprise, and the elites are left scratching their heads and don't understand this phenomenon. That's the kind of figure Bryan was, with this massive public following, and tried to speak for small town America, tried to speak for the integrity of the family, of the local school system, of self-government, local self-government. And I think that's where that religious liberty question comes up too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the background of Bryan. I was interested to find out he was born in Salem, Illinois, which is, I drive by when a couple times a year when I go down to Southern Illinois to go hunt. I'm going down there probably next week, so I'll have to stop by and see if there's any historical markers or anything I can follow up. But what does William Jennings Bryan's background perhaps enable him to do, or how did his background inform him or enable him to become what he eventually became?
Yeah, well, you know, he, from a very early age, you know, his father was a judge. And so the legal training and legal background, he, you know, had that in his own household. His parents took him to a Methodist and Baptist Sunday school on Sunday mornings. But he also attended a Cumberland Presbyterian church. And that's where he was converted as a teenager. And he said that the Sunday school superintendent of that church was the greatest Sunday school superintendent he ever knew. And so he was really thankful for, you know, his training in that church and the Christian education he received there. He went off to Illinois College, which is a Presbyterian college. And he studied there. And later he wrote that he was really thankful for the integration of Christian faith and learning that he received there. And, later became, you know, very concerned about kind of the separation of faith and learning in academia. But he felt that he received a really, you know, he was blessed by the Christian professors that he had there. And then he, went to law school at Union College of Law in Chicago, which is now the Northwestern University School of Law. And he, studied there and worked in a law office that was run. It was a law office of a former United States Senator, Lyman Trumbull. And so that, I think, was a really, formative experience as well. And Trumbull, instructed him to fight against racial injustice, economic injustice. So Bryan, had, I think, a really good education, good legal training. And then he went back to small town Illinois, where he was a lawyer for a few years. And then, Nebraska was growing as a state, and there were opportunities here and potentially political opportunities. And so he moved to Lincoln to be a lawyer. and he started a law partnership with Dolph Talbot, who was one of his classmates from law school. And that's the famous Lincoln law firm of Bryan and Talbot. And inside that building where they had their law office, there was another lawyer who was also a member of the Roundtable Club, who became vice president of the United States. So there was some really famous people here in Lincoln at the time. And that was that vice president, who was a lawyer in Lincoln at the time, was Charles Dawes. Another person in Lincoln at the time who was kind of in this mix was not the time general, but John Pershing. And then also Roscoe Pound, who was one of Charles Bessie's students. Roscoe Pound got a PhD in botany from the University of Nebraska, and later became the longtime dean of Harvard Law School. So there's a lot of interesting people coming out of Lincoln in these years. But yeah, Bryan becomes a congressman, and he, gains, you know, more knowledge as, you know, as a congressman. And then he delivers his famous speech in 1896 at the Democratic National Convention, 36 years old. And it is just a blockbuster speech. It's probably, you know, one of the greatest political speeches in American history. And Bryan is then nominated for the presidency. And he's still, to this day, the youngest person ever nominated for the presidency. So just an amazing political, very, you know, famous political career. And he's very, very influential within, Democratic Party politics for many decades.
That Roundtable Club really intrigued me, Jeff. And there are so many organizations like that in the late 19th century that are really vibrant, especially in the Midwest, a really vibrant intellectual culture, reading groups, discussion groups, and that's a whole subject in itself. But the membership of that, I'm intrigued by it. And when I came to E.A. Ross, I just about fell over because, as you rightly say there, E.A. Ross was one of the most prominent American sociologists, and he was widely read in America, taken very seriously. But he was one of the ugliest eugenicist, racist. He talked about the great dilution with all the immigrants coming to the United States in the late 19th century and the need to keep the Anglo-Saxon race pure in America. And I love these unexpected meeting points, where you have a figure like William Jennings Bryan and E.A. Ross as members of the same club and talking face to face. I would have loved to have been there. And I wonder, Jeff, if there are other figures like that. It's part of the messiness and complexity of history that keeps it so interesting and alive.
Yeah, the Ross participation in the Roundtable Club, I think, is really interesting. Unfortunately, I looked, but I haven't been able to find, you know, they didn't record their discussions, you know, in the club, and there's no papers of the club. The only thing that we get is from Ross's autobiography. He talks about, you know, Bryan making this one comment about, you know, seeing evolution is not just a scientific issue, but one, you know, that involves all of society and the welfare of society. So, Ross was one academic, a leading academic who was a part of this club that Bryan started. And then we also have Charles Bessie, who is really one of the nation's leading botanists and later becomes president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And so, you know, Bessie is a part of this club, and Bessie has more modernist views. And I think that was concerning, you know, to Bryan. The other connection that Bryan had with Bessie is that Bessie was his neighbor. But Bessie, you know, had different political views from Bryan. But, you know, we don't, like I said before, we don't have notes of what was being said, you know, at the meetings. We just know that Bessie was you know, a part of this club, and I'm kind of, you know, speculating that this is what caused Brian to be very concerned, you know, concerned about the strict separation of science and faith. And there is one existent letter that Bessie wrote to a friend in Kansas where he talks about Brian, and that's in the University of Nebraska archives. And he talks about Brian as a friend, but not someone whom he trusts, because he doesn't think Brian is very wise, you know, politically. And so we get some insights there, but there, you know, I wish there was more, you know, but there's only limited information. The other, you know, leading academic who was a part of it was the chancellor of the University of Nebraska, who's a very interesting person, James Canfield. And Canfield really had a populist understanding of a university, and really maintained that. And he was really the most formative chancellor of the University of Nebraska at the time. But Brian, from what I can tell, really agreed with that approach that Canfield had in terms of the university belonging to the people. And if that's the case, then Brian argued, you know, the university cannot undermine or attack the faith of the people. And what's interesting about the University of Nebraska at this time in the late 19th, early 20th century is that Lawrence Vesey, who wrote a very important book on the history of American higher education, he points out that Nebraska was the most spiritual of all the major northern universities. So you have here an intersection of, you know, populism with Christianity. And so what does that mean? And that's, you know, I try to analyze that in the chapter. And you know, this is, I think, an important part of our understanding of American Christianity that sometimes does not get enough attention. And so that's why I wrote this. And I'm trying to get other historians, other evangelical historians, to pay more attention to this issue, because from what I can tell, I just see too many historians that, you know, just fail to bring this into their analysis, basically.
What was Brian seeing at the time in terms of threats, perhaps, to faith in the intellectual circles that he was part of? What was going on in education, both higher and you know, primary, secondary education? What were some of the things that concerned Brian the most?
Well, when Brian ran for president, his wife records that he received many, many letters from parents saying that their children's faith was being attacked or undermined in the public schools and the public universities. And so she notes, Mary Brian notes, that his soul, you know, arose in righteous indignation at this. So this is, you know, 1896. He's conversing with these different scholars. So I think, you know, his views, you know, are being formed over time. But this is an issue that he's very concerned about. And we see it in that comment that he makes to Ross. Richard, do you want to say more about that?
I'm thinking again, you know, how consistent that is as a theme for him. When you get to the Scopes trial, one of his main concerns is, I mentioned before, a question of self-governance, that local communities in the state of Tennessee, don't the people who are paying for the institutions with tax dollars, who are sending their children to these institutions, don't they have the right to expect that what they teach at home and at church will not be destroyed in the classroom? I mean, and that's a question that is as timely 100 years later as it was then. And so you've got this collision. The American journalist and political theorist Walter Lippmann wrote a little book about the Scopes trial called American Inquisitors, and it's really delightful. He has a Platonic dialogue in it. It's a very witty book, but he said that what happened at Dayton, Tennessee was a collision between two authentic American Jeffersonian principles, the right of self-government and the right of intellectual freedom. And he didn't see a solution to that. But that's an important insight right there. And this is the Brian that comes across in the trial transcripts, the Brian who is concerned that the American people, very much a populist theme, that the ordinary American people be allowed to control the institutions that belong to them.
Yeah, and Brian was, you know, he felt that many professors and teachers in the public schools and public universities were not being neutral towards religion. He felt that there was a crude scientism, you know, that existed and was being foisted upon the students, you know, and they were denying, you know, the supernatural. And so that's what he was very concerned about. And I think where, you know, it can be traced back to is in these relationships with, you know, different scholars from the University of Nebraska. If you look at Charles Bessie, the botanist, the professor of botany there, you know, he held to a very tight, strict separation of faith and science. And, you know, he had a modernist perspective on Christianity. And so I think that relationship, you know, helped form some of these beliefs he had. He just felt that if taxpayers were going to pay for these schools, that they should not be attacked. Their faith should not be attacked or undermined. Brian believed that the atheist and agnostic and the Christian should all, you know, be the same legally. And he believed that if atheism was, you know, going to be taught, it should be taught in separate atheist schools. This is what he actually maintained. So, you know, he is in a very influential, you know, figure on these issues of education and faith. And I think many of the issues that he dealt with are still with us today.
Perhaps, you know, pulling some of Brian into the present, as you just mentioned there, what do you have any sense in how Brian might respond to, you know, the secularizing trends? Obviously, he was dealing with modernism and what we saw in the Presbyterian, well, we know about the Presbyterian conflict of the early 20th century. There's so many themes here that overlap with Machen and Brian and was familiar with Machen. What might Brian say when the populists, if the populists, the people, the majority of people paying for the schools were indeed atheists? Does he have any consideration for that and how he deals with things if the tables were turned from his perspective?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, one of the things Brian points out is that the Christians should teach Christianity in Christian schools. So he, I think, had a certain level.
But did he think that as separate from public schools?
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain level of fairness, you know, that Brian had. And he really did believe that people should have freedom of thought, freedom of religion. He emphasized that. And, you know, I think, you know, as an evangelical politician, He had good relationships with, you know, Mormons and Jews. He was trying to win votes. You know, he's trying to win elections. So he really did try to treat people fairly. And even those, you know, who were not Christian believers, he tried to treat fairly. But I think, you know, I get what you're saying with that question. But I think, you know, he does state that Christianity should be taught in Christian schools.
Sure. That's interesting. I'm doesn't always need to come back to Machen. I usually don't want to get that reputation of always thinking that, but I, you know, Machen was pretty well known for being somewhat of a libertarian and even being opposed to the teaching of the Bible in public schools, which would surprise many fundamentalists, certainly. And people would no doubt probably misinterpret his reasons for this. And same thing for, even though he was a teetotaler, his opposition to prohibition, you know, people assume he must be a drunk. Well, he has more deep-seated fundamentalist, or I should say architectonic principles at work, which certainly would get misinterpreted. So it's interesting. I wonder how Brian intersects with some of those themes. I mean, I don't take him, perhaps maybe I've misunderstood or don't know well enough, but I don't take him to have the same type of libertarian streak as Machen, or maybe he did. Is there anything we could say to interact perhaps with some of Machen's ideas on those points?
Brian is certainly a strong prohibitionist. I mean, along with the anti-evolution campaign, he was one of the most visible figures, active, vocal figures in prohibition. And he made common cause in the Presbyterian, the PCUSA, he made common cause with the left wing in the PCUSA for the sake of prohibition. And another side of him is the anti-imperialism of the 1900 campaign, presidential campaign. And people who are really strong anti-imperialists who otherwise hated Bryan's economic policies came over to Bryan in 1900 for the sake of anti-imperialism. So he's a multifaceted figure and was very visible and vocal on the biggest questions facing America at the turn of the century.
Was there anything that really surprised you in your studies of Brian, big or small, as you were engaging this, looking at religious freedom, uncovering some of the details and trying to get to the bottom of the Roundtable Club and looking at Brian with fresh eyes? Was there anything that jumped out at you that perhaps was unexpected?
Well, I think what's jumped out to me, and the reason I wrote this chapter was, I just had in my mind that Brian was, you know, just really intellectually irresponsible. And, looking at this evidence I uncovered, he was making an effort to be, intellectually engaged, and his wife was as well. And so, he was not the scholar that Machen was. But he was a politician, he was a lawyer. And so, I think in that profession, he was doing as well as he could possibly, do. And, he did recognize Machen's, brilliance, and he invited Machen to the Scopes trial. And obviously Machen didn't, do that because he thought it wasn't the best forum to discuss those issues. I think that was kind of Machen's reasoning, that a courtroom is not where this should be discussed. But, I just think Brian needs to be viewed in a different light. I just think that I didn't view him, in the right way. And I think other historians need to be, I think, a little bit more sympathetic to his thought and to the real influence of populism. I just don't think, there's enough sympathy amongst Christian historians, to Brian. It's very interesting, though, even though Brian is a tremendously large figure in American history, even though he was a very, genuine, committed Christian, there's no biography of Brian written by an evangelical historian or a conservative Christian historian. The latest, biography was written by a Georgetown University professor, and it's a good biography, but, I think there's parts of it, he's not a Christian. So it's just, there's things that are missing. And I think if a Christian historian wrote a biography of Brian, I think they would catch on to some things that maybe other historians have not seen.
Just a quick note there that would be perfect for Larson's series for Oxford, the Spiritual Lives series. That'd be perfect.
Yeah, I've been talking to Tim Larson about that, and but I'm just there's some work being done on that, but not sure where it'll go. But it just seems odd that even though Brian is this great evangelical conservative Christian figure, there's just not a biography of him done by, a Christian historian. It just seems very strange. And I think it goes to this issue of Christian historians not giving enough attention to prairie populism, you know, evangelical populism. There's a very interesting history done of South Dakota populism in the late 19th century. And at the very end, the historian that wrote it from the University of South Dakota points out how this populist movement is really fueled by the conservative Christian beliefs of the South Dakotans who participated in it. And it's just, I just think it needs to be understood at a better level. And I think there are some ties between this kind of prairie populism, this political populism, and conservative Christianity. I think we see it in some conservative United Presbyterian theologians like James Orr, who is very against the elites, or, you know, maintain that the everyday, you know, Christian had better spiritual insight than the academic theologians. And Thomas Whitelaw, another leading evangelical United Presbyterian scholar, you know, held to the same view. So what does this mean for, what is this populist viewpoint? What does it mean for Presbyterianism? I think that's an important question that needs to be asked. You know, I think Machen had some sympathy with this. I think that's, you know, he wanted to, he wasn't, you know, committed to just the East Coast. He went to North Dakota to try to share his message there too. So, you know, I think there's just some interesting connections here between populism and conservative Protestantism that need more analysis.
Might be interesting for someone to take an afternoon and tally up all the religious or political figure biographies and see and plot them on a map and see how many tend toward the coasts versus the supposed flyover country. It'd be just, I don't know, it'd be an interesting graph. Maybe that would lead to some further conversations and some more attention on some significant figures that haven't been given their due.
There's a really important effort right now to revive Midwestern history. The original Mississippi Valley Historical Association and Journal was truly that. It was a Midwestern journal, and that was destroyed. And there's a great movement by a South Dakotan to revive Midwestern history, and they would. Yeah. There you go. Yes, absolutely. The good country. Go ahead, Jeff. Say more about that. They have a new historical association that meets every, early every June.
Yeah, just John Lauk up in Sioux Falls. He teaches at the University of South Dakota. You know, he just points out how, you know, amongst historians, the emphasis is put on the coast, the West Coast, the East Coast, and also the American South. There's a lot of Southern historians. But Midwest history, he says, has really been de-emphasized. And he says that's a real shame because of the importance of the Midwest in our country's history. And he discusses all that and analyzes it in this book and just really shows how important the Midwest is in our nation's history and all the advancements. In many ways, the Midwest is the most advanced part of American civilization. He makes that argument in this book. You know, if it wasn't for, you know, two people from Illinois, you know, we may not have won the Civil War, you know. So there's just a lot of, you know, important things that John points out in this book on that topic.
Yeah. All right. As a person from Illinois, born and raised, I appreciate that comment, Jeff.
And Brian's from Illinois.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Salem. Yeah, right there off I-57. So interesting. Ronald Reagan as well. Barack Obama. You know, there's all sorts of interesting connections with Illinois. But the Midwest as a whole. Yeah, that I'm very excited. You just added another excellent book to my list of books that I take too long to read. So I'll have to pick that up and certainly have a link to that in the episode description and follow up. We can do a revisitation, take it back up and dive down more into Midwestern studies. We've had some, there've been a few Midwest focused, addresses at the Presbyterian Scholars Conference. I believe, just last year, there was one on the Dutch influence, the Midwest and Grand Rapids influence of Calvin grads going off to Princeton. So that was an interesting topic. And there's a lot of interaction. Ken Stewart did that one, and there's a lot of interaction with some other themes. But more scholarship on the subject, I think, is certainly warranted. Is Brian... how much is Brian forever just ingrained or linked with Nebraska versus, I don't know, some people seem to be more regional. Obviously, Brian was a national figure, having been the Democratic nominee three times over. Would you characterize him more as an American or a Nebraskan? Maybe this is a very South Carolina way to think about things, or a Virginian way to think about things from the 19th century. But what might you say? How might that be applied, or how might those categories really not apply to Brian?
Yeah, I think he's generally known as a, a Nebraska figure, someone who's, young adult life was formed here and he became famous here. He did retire to Florida. So I think in the 19 teens, he moved to Florida. His wife had some health issues, so they moved down there. But he's a famous Nebraskan, and we've never had a president. He's the closest that we've come to having a president. I think, he was also U.S. Secretary of State from 1913 to 1915. So that's a very prominent, position, for a, very solid, Christian to have. And he's a Christian statesman. And I think he's more influential than we realize. He wasn't a perfect person, and he had his issues, and people may have political disagreements with him and so on and so forth. But I do think, he genuinely cared about people. I do think that he cared about, the common person. He cared about, what farmers were going through. He cared about, he really did. He had love for people, I believe. So I think he's an important American figure, and someone I think that we need to, look at. I think maybe for the OPC, I know you have OPC listeners. So in many ways, Brian is not, the ideal Presbyterian. He was not a confessionalist, a strict confessionalist. He lived before the OPC was founded. So, you can't be, too hard on him. And I think, he just had God put him in a different position, in life to run for the presidency. And I do feel he really was a faithful Christian. He was a genuine Christian. He accomplished, some good things. But I do think his insights on secularism and the strict separation of science and faith, I think we should be concerned about those today as well.
Mm. It is a shame that we don't have records of the Roundtable Club, or that they didn't start a podcast back then. That'd been nice to listen to. But certainly picking up on that, diving down into that even more would be tremendous. I don't even know if there would be any other historical sources that could be investigated to find out more about that organization. Did you find any, or are you aware, maybe this is a little bit of a takeaway for people, that we can learn some things from this chapter and apply them to our own lives, perhaps. Did you find any other historical analogs to the Roundtable Club? We talked about the League of Evangelical Students, which is perhaps tangentially related. And then I guess following up on that, are there any present day efforts to do the kinds of things that Brian was trying to accomplish with the club?
Yeah, I mean, I think reading, book clubs, reading clubs, you know, those are somewhat similar. But I think to Richard's point, I think those were much larger things in the, you know, in the 19th century that just aren't emphasized today. There's a lot of other, you know, distractions. But I just, you know, Paolo Coletta, who is a historian at the U.S. Naval Academy, in his biography of Brian, he points this out. And I just thought it deserved, you know, further analysis of what was going on and who was participating. And so I thought, you know, I should try to do that and just try to understand how that club may have formed Brian's view. So that's what I was doing, you know, in the chapter, and just want to encourage, you know, listeners to check it out if they have the opportunity.
Well, sure. And perhaps those are other ways that we can learn a lesson from Brian, not only to revisit and understand Brian on his own terms in his own context, rather than bringing to the fore popular cinematic depictions of him that may or may not be accurate, but also learning perhaps something from his example. Is interesting to hear of Bessie, the botanist, who had a very, you know, is a modernist approach to things. And maybe Brian, not being a strict confessionalist, but also, you know, being known as a fundamentalist rather than a liberal, is interacting regularly with people of that sort. That perhaps is something that we can learn from, that we can have regular scholarly intellectual conversations in good faith with people with whom we may disagree, even sharply. That's something that seems to be missing in popular culture. There's all sorts of other things we could open up perhaps on another day. We don't have much of a public square anymore. We don't have a way to have an open exchange of ideas, but there's also, for technological and sociological reasons, there's all sorts of echo chambers, tribalism. There's a lot of factors involved, and perhaps Brian has become the victim of some of those effects after his passing. But it's certainly something, a reminder to us, I think, to look at things more honestly, with open eyes, and to investigate them again within the historical context and on their own terms, rather than bringing our own ideas to the study in advance.
I think well, you know, what's at issue here is that many historians, you know, Christian historians, they view Brian's performance at Dayton as something, you know, so bad that it totally injured the conservative Christian movement. And so Brian, you know, is not someone who they really want to look to. But what I'm trying to say here is that there's more to the story. And I think some of Brian's concerns are very legitimate and something that we need to think about today.
Yeah, I appreciate that. People can find the chapter to the book, certainly. We'll have it posted, a link to that in the episode description. But the title of the book is The Gospel and Religious Freedom, published just in June, just this summer, by Baylor University Press. And it's by our guest today, Jeffrey McDonald. And check out Jeff's other books as well, a book on John Gerstner and the renewal of Presbyterian and Reformed Evangelicalism in Modern America. And I do also want to thank Richard Gamble for joining us today. He's authored many, many different books and articles, and we'll have links to many of those in the episode description too. But this has been really fun. I appreciate both of you joining me, and look forward to continuing the conversation into the future. But thanks so much, brothers.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ken. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you got it. Visit psconference.org for information on the Presbyterian Scholars Conference, hillsdale.edu for information about Hillsdale College, the beautiful location I just visited a week and a half ago. You can take a look at that wonderful place, also a bastion of religious freedom and doing things independently and being unashamed about it. So we're very thankful for them and for the many people that teach there. Not only Richard, but also Daryl Hart and others. And you can find us online as well at reformedforum.org. Check out the website. You'll find information about our upcoming events, upcoming publications, including new books. We have a new book by Scott Wright on regeneration, so take a look at that. And many new courses. All of our video courses are available for free. We try to get them translated all into Spanish and Chinese and looking at other languages as well and distributed around the world for anyone who'd like to learn about Reformed history, theology, biblical studies, all sorts of things. We're plowing away, working hard to try to make those resources available and accessible to anyone who'd like to reach them. I would like to thank everybody for listening, of course, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.